Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hello, hello. This is Mike Lee from Vancouver, Canada. A huge fan of all the underarm servers out there. You are listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to your penultimate tennis podcast of 2021. A particular hello to Mike Lee, who you heard assisting with our intro there. Mike is going to be guest editing today's show, or actually, in fact, has guest edited today's show. He has selected from your submissions some listener questions, and he's put his own in there as well. David, Mike sounds like he means business to me. I suddenly feel quite a lot of pressure to perform in this listener question special.
Yeah, devotee of the underarm serve, and I noticed that one of his questions is about the underarm serve as well. So, I know that if I'm returning his serve, I'm going to be on my toes.
He's worried that the underarm serve, I don't want to spoiler anything for later in the show, but he's worried that the underarm serve is a flash in the pan trend and not here to stay. So hopefully, spoiler alert, we can provide assurances for you, Mike, later in the show. Yes, it's our penultimate show of 2021. Listener questions. We'll be back next week with listener questions. And then the tennis season starts. But actually, the tennis season in some ways has already begun for 2022 because we have had the Abu Dhabi Mubadala Open.
A World Championships or something.
The Mubadala World five Championships with a few people in it, and with poor Emma Raducanu stuck in a local hotel in self-isolation because she has got COVID. She had to collect her BBC Sports Personality of the Year trophy last night, which had magically appeared in her hotel room from self-isolation. She didn't fake being surprised about winning because clearly she had the trophy right next to her. She just sort of held it up and went, well, yeah, because I've got the trophy.
Well, they'd all got a trophy, all the people at remote destinations, apparently, in case they won.
Did they?
But I do agree with you. There absolutely was no look of great shock to her response.
Which I appreciated. She's of course, a very worthy winner. And to do that in an Olympic year, when Great Britain was so successful at the Tokyo Olympics as well, is extraordinary. I, Matt, didn't think that Tom Daley looked too happy about that result. Did you detect a bit of saltiness from Tom Daley? Or was I looking too hard?
I don't know whether Tom Daley does saltiness, does he?
I don't know. Watch it back, Matt. I thought he looked just a tad salty.
It was a bit awkward for those that were there, wasn't it?
Yes, just awkwardly hanging out on the stage, staring at a screen where... Mm. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was... Yeah.
I would love to hear one of those sort of runner-up speeches where they just go, I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, how...
I've got a great personality.
Have you lot chosen her over me? I mean, yes, she's won the US Open, but did you see what I did?
It's amazing how parochial people get about their sports, isn't it? You know, how have these people you know, comparing within sports, it's like comparing, sorry, inter-sports comparisons, it's like intergenerational comparisons in tennis, isn't it? It leads nowhere. It's impossible. It is inevitably subjective. And yet there is so much het-upness about it, which is mostly amusing and sometimes infuriating. But yes, that's happened. The Mubadala World Team Brilliant Tennis Championships has happened. Andrei Rublev had his 2 days off and was back in action. Don't know how much of the Maldives he squeezed in to those 2 days. Don't think maybe that Andrei Rublev does the Maldives. But anyway, tennis is back. Yeah, that happened. But when tennis is sort of properly back, we'll be talking about it, of course. But in the meantime, we have Mike and we have listener questions, and they're good ones. They're really good questions here. So let's get stuck into them. The first from Mike: imagine you were told by a time traveller from the future that Novak Djokovic ended his career with fewer majors than Rafael Nadal, despite having no major injury issues for the remainder of his career. How could you imagine a scenario like this playing out in a plausible way? And what do you think are the chances something like this could happen? Well, I think there's a... I don't think it's a likely scenario by any stretch of the imagination. I definitely think that Novak Djokovic is highly likely to end up with more majors than Nadal and Federer. But I certainly think it's entirely plausible that Djokovic doesn't win any more slams and Nadal wins one more French Open this year. That's not silly to me. It's not what I'm predicting will happen, but yeah, I could see it happening. You know, Djokovic doesn't play the Australian Open because he's not vaccinated. He loses momentum. Nadal focuses on the clay season, comes in, sneaks the French, and then suddenly, the landscape all looks a bit different, doesn't it? Nothing's for certain. That is my feeling on it. Does anybody feel differently, Matt?
No, I think I share your opinion overall. I think the Grand Slam race, as I like to call it, rather than the GOAT debate, I suppose, has sort of constantly shifted in this way. There have been times when it really looked like Federer was going to finish with the most. I think when Nadal equaled him at Roland Garros in 2020, I would have thought Nadal would finish with the most. And with Djokovic doing what he did this year, I suddenly think he's probably going to finish with the most. So if history has taught us anything, it's that things can change quite quickly and it can veer off in a different direction. I agree, of course, Djokovic looks primed to finish with the most at the moment. But yeah, there's a plausible scenario where he doesn't play the Australian Open. There's a plausible scenario, I think, where a vaccine mandate comes into more tournaments and Djokovic will have a decision to make there as well. There's a plausible scenario where Medvedev becomes, I think, his equal on a hard court at this stage in his career anyway. You know, team, we've got still to come back. Zverev has made improvements on hard court. I think those hard court slams might get harder for Djokovic to win over the next few years. He still seems quite far ahead at Wimbledon to me. That's the one where I think someone is really going to have to step up and stop Djokovic. But yeah, it's possible that they might. And obviously the sort of second part of this scenario is we need Nadal to win one more major and, of course, never write him off at the French Open. I mean, frankly, anywhere, but in particular the French Open. He is so great there. He's already won 13. It doesn't seem like that huge an ask to think that he might win one more, especially considering what it took for Djokovic to beat him this year at the French Open. It's not likely that Djokovic will play that well again, I think, at Roland Garros. And he only just beat Nadal. You know, he won fair and square in four sets, but it was a mighty effort. And, you know, I think it's entirely possible that Nadal goes into Roland Garros as the favourite in a few months' time, depending on how his foot is and how his injuries are. So, yeah, I agree. I think, of course, Djokovic is favoured to end up with the most, but it's not impossible that he doesn't.
Yeah, there have been so many moments where scenarios have felt inevitable, haven't they? And then suddenly, you know, things change on a dime, and you realise how silly you are and how much recency bias there is. And David, of course, you think they're all ending on 20, don't you? Which I'm so here for.
Well, I think it's unlikely now. But I think it doesn't feel impossible either, because I do think tension is going to grow for Djokovic and the field are going to get closer. And there's going to be more of them. I think Medvedev in particular has put his head out and shown that he can take him out when he's playing his best stuff. I think the thing with the injuries, the assumption here is that Djokovic is fully fit for the remainder of his career, or at least not suffering major injuries. But I think Nadal's fitness is just as critical to Nadal having any say in this matter. And we would require, I think if Nadal managed to get back to full fitness himself, he could win two or three more French Opens. Because I think about Federer, what was it, 4 years ago that he won two or three in the space of a couple of years. And that would have put him at the same sort of age as Nadal is now, or will be. And other things being equal, Nadal is still far and away the best player at Roland Garros, generally speaking. Yes, he didn't win this last one, but I agree with Matt. You'd still make him the favourite if he's fit. And until Alcaraz comes along and catches him up and overtakes him, which I think will happen in a couple of years' time,
it's in your diary, David.
Well, you know, yeah, I think. I mean, Alcaraz almost looks like he's tracking ahead of what I thought he would, really, in terms of that prediction. I can't exactly remember which date I put on it because it was a different phone and I've lost it. But anyway, it was about 3 years or something.
Have you
like
not
that.
Transferred your iCal?
I don't know how to do that.
I think it will have automatically transferred.
It hasn't. I've been searching.
Which means that when the time comes, you can be extremely vague about it, which is very annoying.
It's good, isn't it?
No, we definitely tweeted it. There was definitely a
Oh, yes,
a
we did. We did. You can't escape from your internet history, David.
All right.
Those are facts. Okay, well, just to round off this question with the supplementary question then, if I had to ask you for a prediction now, on Monday the 20th of December 2021, who you are predicting to win the men's French Open title in 2022, what name would you give me?
I will give you the name Rafael Nadal.
David, I am so sorry to do this, but I've done it now.
Carlos Alcaraz.
Oh my
God. You didn't. Hang on, I feel like about 3 weeks ago you were saying Casper Ruud was going to win it.
No. He's going to lose in the final.
Casper Ruud is going to lose in the final to Carlos Alcaraz.
Yeah. That's what you come here for, folks.
We might be done.
How on earth do we follow that?
Mics have dropped all around.
Are you serious, David?
Billie Jean's dropped her mic. Look at that.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean, when I think about it, look, what I've said about Nadal is if he's fully fit, he's a favourite. Do you really think he's going to be fully fit? That foot? I don't know. I'm not confident in that foot. I don't think he is either. Djokovic is, yeah, he played out of his mind in order to win that French Open just gone. But you put him up against a fast improving Carlos Alcaraz, I'm not sure that he takes him out. Then you look at everybody else. Medvedev's not that
comfortable.
There's
a difference between a one-off win, though, and a back-to-back.
Alcaraz just
best
looks like
five,
he's improving
seven.
At such yeah, look, a
I,
rate.
I and agree. In 2023, yeah, sure, I'll...
How, David, do I'll you feel about back you up. Dominic Thiem's wrist compared to Rafa Nadal's foot?
Not confident. Okay. Look,
he's
I don't,
been, he's been you... taken out by a non-COVID cold at the moment, Dominic Thiem.
Yes, he's delaying
he said,
his
he said, I've got
trip
a cold,
Australia.
Brackets, not COVID. But he's not playing his scheduled warm-up events for the Australian Open, which isn't it's not coming back with a bang, is it?
I'm always worried about wrist injuries. I think he will get back, but I don't feel confident that
he's lost a lot, hasn't he?
It takes time to build up. You know, you saw him when he returned last year. It took him a while. He couldn't seem to get any confidence either and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
I don't know. And I look around and there are other players. Medvedev doesn't convince me on clay. I don't think he ever will. Tsitsipas, look, his game's perfect for it, isn't it?
Well, he's just had surgery.
But he's just had surgery. There are unknowns about him in that regard. And we saw what Alcaraz did to him, you know?
It's all about Alcaraz, Matt. It's coming back to Alcaraz.
And look, I mean, Zverev is getting closer on all of these services, maybe apart from grass. He's getting closer. But I still think that the natural one, he's the natural, is Alcaraz.
I agree. He's going to win French Opens. I just don't know if he's going to do it in 2022. But I love it, David.
But it's just my...
I love it.
My prediction is in.
Right. I'm afraid, folks, the rest of the podcast is going to be a disappointment because we've peaked very early, but we'll do what we can. The next question is about underarm serving.
I wonder if there are any takers out there who agree with me.
There's a difference between agreeing it's possible, which I'm sure many would, and of course it's possible, and predicting it. You think that is the most likely scenario? Anyway, we must move on, David.
What did Alcaraz do this year? I can't even remember.
He beat Tsitsipas at the US Open.
No, but at the French Open, I can't remember what sort of French Open he had.
Well, he got injured in Madrid. Did he play the French Open?
See, it's all coming together, just like Nadal. Remember when he came on the scene and he couldn't play the French Open until he won it?
Mm.
No, but he did play the French Open, as it turns out. And he lost in the third round to Jan-Lennard Struff.
Oh, that's a bit disappointing. Come on, Carlos, pull your socks up.
He'd just turned 18, David.
That's probably where he's more vulnerable against a big guy who's just going to blitz it, and knock him off the court with serves and that. I'm still going with it.
Okay. Right, then we must move on to underarm serving, folks, because this is definitely what Mike is in this for. This is where I feel the pressure to deliver for our guest editor, Mike. Okay. He says, since Michael Chang did his famous underarm serve many years ago, it was barely used in professional tennis. More recently, though, we've seen many of the top players, Medvedev, Bublik, Kyrgios, and even Murray, employ this tactic. Do you see this trend continuing? Interestingly, what struck me, and it's absolutely accurate, but what struck me about that, the list of players, is there's no female players. I can't think, why are the women not underarm serving? Why has the trend not been reflected in the women's game?
Sara Errani does it, but for different reasons.
Yeah, she can't serve. Mm. I mean, I do it sometimes because I can't serve.
Do you?
I've got a real ball toss problem, yeah.
You've done one in a match?
I did it once in a family Christmas Day doubles game.
Did you announce you were going to do it, or did you just...
No.
How did that go down?
Too embarrassing.
Who's
Matt
on the other end?
My mum and my brother. Oh, I think Math swatted it away for a dismissive winner.
Oh,
you know.
So you didn't get any of that Alexander Bublik proper underspin wearing?
No. It was a mark of absolute desperation.
Right.
Anyway, we're discussing here the tactical underarm serve.
Yes.
So taking away Sara Errani, I don't think, why are they not doing it?
I mean, I can only think of Hingis. I can't think of any other female player who's done it. I can't even remember seeing the Errani once, but I mean, I totally understand why she would do it, given how awful her serve is.
David.
It's like a little pat up in the air.
Okay, well, maybe that's a separate question, but one to consider. I would love to see it continuing. I worry that in the way that it's currently deployed, the underarm serve, it has sort of reached a plateau of its usage, and it's very much used as a disruption shot, isn't it? Just throw it in. Everybody always claims afterwards when they're asked about it that, you know, they hadn't given it much thought. It was just, oh, I'll throw this in. I wish it was, you know, just a recognised tactic, and in practice sessions, it was something that you discussed with coaches, you know, when they're in this return position or in this sort of situation, this is when it'd be useful to use that underarm serve. And I don't know, I feel like that would be the next progression of it, to, for it to be a recognised formal tool in the game rather than just a disruption. I mean, I'm glad that it is even used in the capacity that it is. I, too, am a massive fan of the underarm serve. But and maybe if it becomes a sort of standard part of the toolkit, it'll become less fun. But I feel like that would be the next step in the evolution of the underarm serve. What do you guys think?
Well, do you agree? I mean, you will both know better than me that there was a gap from Michael Chang to now. Is that fair to say that it did basically, it was non-existent, really?
A gap that was filled by most pundits saying they thought it was disrespectful.
Okay.
And,
so,
and an assumption that Michael Chang actually only did it because he was cramping.
So it didn't happen not for tactical reasons, but for, as you've said, it was seen as disrespectful. It was seen as a disruption. What I find interesting is that there's perhaps something to be said for this younger generation we've got now, Bublik, Medvedev, Kyrgios perhaps, sort of being quite willing to express themselves on a tennis court. And I know Bublik was asked about this during the Davis Cup. And look, tennis is probably not as sort of progressive a space as it should be, but I think generally society is more so. And you heard Medvedev's comments at Davis Cup saying he didn't want to follow Nadal and Federer. He wants to be himself on the court. And I wonder, sort of a top player like that saying something like that, whether that will filter down to younger players and they'll think, yeah, to hell with it. I don't care. An underarm serve is fine. And even if it is frowned upon, I don't care. That's me. That's what I want to do. So I wonder whether we've overcome that barrier of it being considered disrespectful, or we will overcome that barrier over the next few years. But I do agree, for tactical reasons, that's what needs to happen, I think, for it to be cemented in the game. People need to be using it tactically. And I'm not sure whether we're quite there yet. But I think we've probably overcome the barrier of sort of being embarrassed about using it.
I disagree about the tactical side. I think that is happening now. I think Murray said that very openly. If the guy's going to... Who did he do it against? I can't remember now. But he said if he's going to stand
Alcaraz?
Back...
Was it Alcaraz? I think it was Alcaraz at Indian Wells.
He said if he's going to stand back there, it seems like a good tactic. So he did it. And
He did, David, but he also claimed it only just came to him in the moment, that he didn't go into the match with it in his toolkit.
I could imagine a coach against the real extremes of playing at the back, Thiem, Medvedev, Nadal, one or two like that, Wawrinka if he comes back, players who stand with their backs to the backstop and who are probably going to end up becoming more prevalent because it does tend to go in that trend of following what the top players are doing, and those are the guys that everybody's watching now. Give yourself more room, wind up into the thing, make yourself impossible to beat from the back of the courts, make them miss, all that sort of thing. I think that there will be more coaches, and it's still going to be more as a disruptor. You're not going to see somebody hitting 10 normal serves and 3 underarm serves, but I think I could imagine seeing one a set in certain matches where a player just thinks, just going to chuck it in, just keep the guy guessing, the player guessing. And I would imagine maybe it's going to... I think probably one of the reasons it hasn't come in the women's game yet is I don't think players are staying as far back because they don't need to leave themselves quite as much room for the serve, to return the serve. Maybe that's one of the reasons. But I think once one player does it, and I can imagine Ons Jabeur doing it, I can imagine Iga Świątek doing it, players like that who've got that flair and that imagination, then I think it could start coming in more over. But, you know, like I say, it's generally speaking an easier serve to return, obviously. But as a tactic, just as to get the player guessing, I can imagine it coming in more than it is right now, and certainly as a tactic.
Music to Mike's ears, David.
You and me, Mike.
I get the feeling, knowing what I do about Mike, that was what he wanted to hear.
I haven't been able to play Solihull Simon for the last 6 months because he's been injured. And obviously I've had my long COVID a little bit the last few months, so I haven't played too much. But we've talked about getting out there again. And I honestly just really hope it occurs to me to hit one at some point soon, because I want to have a go in a match.
Does Solihull Simon stand way behind the baseline?
To receive David's serve, Matt, would you? Did you?
I didn't.
Yeah, but I wasn't having a good service day that day, Matt.
Right.
Know. I've been getting the howitzers out since then. So he stands further back than you, Matt, because he doesn't have a double-handed backhand that he can lean on. He has only a slice backhand, and he always runs around and always hits inside out forehand. So he's got to leave himself plenty of room for that sort of combo. Mm.
Very Greg Rozetsky.
Yeah. He'll be delighted with that.
Get well soon, Solihull Simon. What's the injury?
Knee injury. We get those at our age.
Is he on the track back to fitness?
Yeah, well, he's playing doubles with us. So, and he, you know, I think I might have convinced him.
Okay, all right. So it sounds like he is fit to play, David. He's just not playing you.
He's ducking me.
Yeah, okay. Running scared. Right, well, Mike, I hope you're satisfied with that answer about the underarm serve. Yes, the trend is continuing, and David Law is going to be the one to continue it. He's taking it upon himself, Mike, just for you.
It is a fact that whenever we see one, we all celebrate, but don't we?
Oh, so. Yeah.
Do you remember when Daniil Medvedev serve and volleyed behind an underarm
big
serve?
Big time.
One of the moments of the season.
It was a second serve and volley on match point, wasn't it?
Tremendous.
Yeah.
Sebastian just hit it straight past him.
Yeah, I mean, stupid, but great. Okay, question number three from Mike. He says, if the Laver Cup were to get rid of the Europe versus World format, how would you redesign the two teams? For me, it would probably be the next-gen players versus the old guard with an age cut-off of around 28, or perhaps champions players with at least two majors versus everybody else. And he's popped a little smiley face on the end of this question.
He's on a wind-up, isn't he?
He is. Look, this is not really the question. But for me, the answer is any significant format change which doesn't incorporate women is silly. It's such an obvious...
Billie Jean agrees.
That's the equivalent of in Parliament when they all shout, "Hear, hear, hear."
yeah,
Billie Jean, yes, it's all good, it's all good. Quiet, it was the postman. Billie Jean, quiet. Oh, now there's a fox on the telly. Quiet, good girl. Okay. I mean, yes, you could do one of those format changes Mike suggested. Maybe they would be interesting. But why wouldn't you just make it a mixed event and make it a lot better? Sorry, Mike, if that's not answering
the specifics
your question.
Of
but
his
it's
question,
just so obvious.
Catherine, if you were going to get rid of Europe against World, is there something else that would work? I mean, let's assume that they're also at the same time going to bring women in and make it that. Is there a... Because I must admit, I've really struggled with this. I've been thinking about it since I read the question last night, and I'm struggling with it in terms of coming up with a format that I would care about. That's the problem. You need to... They were trying to get the equivalent of Europe against the US in Ryder Cup. Something that... And look, if somebody had told me before I discovered the Ryder Cup that Europe against the United States was going to be a thing that I would care about, I would have been a bit surprised about that in a way, I think, because it's not the most obvious colours to nail your affections towards and your loyalties towards, I don't think. Because it's always to me been Great Britain or England as an English person myself. I just don't know. What do you think, Matt?
Well, I mean, the Laver Cup has gone down the route of trying to be more and more legitimate in terms of the ATP claiming to count head-to-heads and getting that designated spot in the calendar and having qualification scenarios, whatever. And I think maybe for the long term, if they do want it to be a Ryder Cup type event, those are the sort of things, the sort of steps they needed to take to make it like that, to sort of solidify its place in the tennis calendar. I personally just think it should go all in with the exhibition route and just be a fun all-star event that should be men and women, absolutely, and there should be a draft of picking teams and, you know, just the whole thing really embrace entertainment, I suppose, more than anything. We don't need the Laver Cup, but it can be a nice addition to the season is sort of how I end up thinking about it. And yeah, I suppose there is room to do quirky things like young players versus older players, or a team of lefties versus a team of righties, or a team of single-handers versus a team of double-handers. Like, you could mix it up every year, I don't know. But just personally, I think it should embrace those exhibition elements more rather than do what it has done, which is try and become more and more legitimate. Look, I might be in the complete minority there, but
no, I'm with you on that. Yeah, and that's something we say every time we review a Laver Cup, isn't it? Exhibition is not a dirty word. Some people won't be interested in anything other than, you know, tour, Grand Slam, ranking points tennis, but plenty are, and that's great. That's great. There's absolutely a market and a place for exhibition tennis. Make yourself the ultimate exhibition. Love the idea of a draft. Really, really love the idea of a draft. That would be something that could set it apart. Yeah, I mean, they're not. I don't think those are bad suggestions, Mike, that you make. I mean, but you're gonna come up against the issue with the fact that it is, it's not automatic entry. It's, I mean, I know they've sort of fudged some kind of legitimate entry criteria, haven't they? But we know it's an invitational event with appearance fees. So trying to create that sort of format in an invitational scenario, next gen versus old guard, well, you're going to have all the next gen players absolutely queuing up to play Laver Cup, aren't you? You know, big check guaranteed, but are you going to get enough of the, you know, Djokovic isn't keen on it, is he? If you're going to have old guard, does that work without Djokovic? I'm not sure that it does. And if Djokovic chooses not to play, then instantly the whole event is sort of delegitimized, isn't it? Or champions versus everyone else. But then you've got the issue of, you know, you need the event is premised on, or is trying to be premised on, as you say, David, making crowds care. And I don't know, is that going to make crowds care any more than...
I mean, ultimately, I think the easiest fix, if you think the Laver Cup is broken, which maybe it isn't, it has been a successful event, I think the easiest fix is to stick with Europe versus the world and add women.
Yeah. Because that would even it up in terms of competition as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Done. Okay. That's sorted.
That'll do then. but yeah, but not try. I still think it is trying. It might not admit to this, but I think it is trying to take Davis Cup's fire and roll, and that into, because of how much it wants to mean something, and I don't think it should do that. But anyway,
lean into the fun.
Many a time we've talked about
fun.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Right then, question number 4 that Mike has suggested. It comes in from Ron Buckmeyer on Twitter. Oh, God. Oh, God, I've just remembered what this question is. I'm anxious. He says, can you predict the top 5 ranked players on the ATP and WTA tours at the end of 2022?
Yes, I can.
Carlos Alcaraz, Casper Ruud.
I've actually made a late change in the last 48 seconds.
Off you go then, David. Yeah. It's over to you.
So I've drafted Carlos Alcaraz in based on my spur-of-the-moment
decision.
Hang on
a second.
That he was going to win.
He wasn't even in your top 5.
No. I suddenly realised that that was slightly flawed, given that he's going to win the French Open in 6 months' time. So I've drafted him into number 4.
Who did he replace?
Stefanos Tsitsipas is gone. So your top 5 on the ATP circuit are Daniil Medvedev, Alexander Zverev, Novak Djokovic, Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner.
Okay, in your women's?
Ash Barty, Paula Badosa, Iga Swiatek, Garbiñe Muguruza and Naomi Osaka.
I just don't know.
Well, I don't know, Catherine. You've just got to be decisive and then people think you do know.
Okay, no, so this is... okay, are the parameters of this, we're assuming everyone stays fit because you can't predict injury. Or, for example, David, have you not selected Stefanos Tsitsipas because you think he's going to have an injury hit year?
It's definitely a factor that included. I've included team in that as well. I've included Nadal in that. You know, these are players that I don't think they're inferior to the ones I've chosen, but I am concerned about them.
Tsitsipas is an interesting one. I could see him sort of not coping with a major injury well. You know, maybe trying to come back too soon or push it too far. I don't know. This is an interesting curveball for Tsitsipas that, maybe he'll pass it with flying colours. But I could see, you know, that being an ongoing blight throughout his season. I don't know currently what his predicted sort of recovery trajectory is from that surgery. But Tsitsipas certainly, he's not an automatic top 5 for me. Can you tell that I'm stalling for time?
Yep. Yes, Matt, carry on.
I mean, I've seen videos of Tsitsipas hitting already. Like, I'm not sure it is a major injury, a major surgery he's had. I think it's minor, but I agree. I share the concerns generally, but I think I have him in my top 5. Mine looks a lot like David's. I would have Medvedev, Djokovic, Zverev, Tsitsipas, and I think I'm going to put team in there. Just maybe that's out of hope that his injury is not too bad. But I think it's a big leap for Alcaraz to get into the top 5.
French Open helps.
I think it's quite a big leap for Jannik Sinner. Sinner, I think, is my... He feels like the most interesting player to watch maybe next year to see what that trajectory is going to be.
see what that Davis Cup did to it as well.
Yeah, to see what that end of year experience did to him, to see whether he can carry that forward. I think we're reaching the point where he will have played the number of matches that he and Piatti were talking about that he needs, and that will be the moment where he sort of, you know, truly breaks through. But I have real belief in Dominic Thiem, and if he is fit, I think we're going to see him back to what he was in 2019 and 2020 as well, which is competing for the biggest title. So I'm going to say not much movement among the men. The women's hard, very, very hard. I feel confident about Ash Barty. I feel pretty confident about Garbiñe Muguruza. I had Świątek as well. I had Osaka as well, because I think, you know, I think she can get another big win somewhere, maybe.
Is this in order,
you know, perhaps the US Open, sort of. And I think maybe Sabalenka. I'm not necessarily predicting her to win a slam, but I think she can have another season doing what she did this year, which is sort of cleaning up at some events and making progress at slams. And that feels probably like it might be enough for a top five.
Yeah, the women's is hard. Yeah, I feel confident in Ash Barty. Ash Barty's going to be there. I think Krejcikova's going to be there.
Oh, no, I didn't choose Krejcikova.
Yeah.
I feel so bad.
I don't know. I feel confident in Krejcikova.
So do I. Can I change?
But you have to sub someone out, David.
Right, carry on.
Świątek had the most sort of consistent slam season of anyone last year. She's really sort of proved her consistency, but she's, you know, she's just split with her coach. There's maybe a bit of, I definitely don't see her dropping away. I see her definitely top 10, maybe not top five. Muguruza is really filling me with confidence at the moment. So I'm going to go Barty, Muguruza, Krejcikova. I really want to put Ons Jabeur in there, and that's heart over head, but I want to do it. I'm going to go Osaka. I'm going to go Osaka. So I've got one more spot. And do I ill-advisedly give it to Ons Jabeur, or do I? I'm going to go Sabalenka. Sorry, Ons. I'm going to go Sabalenka for the same reasoning as Matt. On the men's side, definitely Medvedev. Djokovic, assuming that more tournaments don't bring in mandatory vaccine policies, that is a potential massive curveball in men's tennis. That seriously changes the complexion of a lot of things. But if that doesn't happen, then Djokovic, I do think Zverev will stay hanging around in the top five. Rublev is currently number five, isn't he? I think he might have maxed out there, Rublev, so it's just a question of whether he can, you know, hang around there or thereabouts. I'm going to put Thiem in as well, Matt. I'm going to put him there. Nobody's mentioned Felix Auger-Aliassime. Have we lost a bit of faith in him? Because I think 2 years ago, if we'd been asked for predictions 2 years ahead, we might have put him there.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't even occur to me.
No. He's 11 in the world at the moment. Okay, I'm going to go for Zverev, Medvedev, Djokovic, Thiem, and Ruud.
Really?
I don't know. I don't know.
I wasn't expecting that.
I was not expecting that from you.
I think he's going to be really consistent.
Of course he is.
Oh, yeah.
We know that. I told you that a year ago. However, you always, whenever I bring up Ruud, you slightly roll your eyes.
Don't make me defend it, David. I just threw him in there at the last minute. Could be anyone. Could be Sinner. It's probably going to be Sinner, isn't it? Oh, I don't know. Who are you subbing in for? Who are you subbing out for Krejcikova, David?
Oh, I'm gonna lose Świątek. She's gonna go to six.
You're keeping Badosa and getting rid of Świątek.
Yeah, she was number three a minute ago. Now she's number six. I actually ordered them.
Yeah, I'm going to duck out of doing that. Okay. God, the women's is hard, isn't it? It feels like there's about 15 women that deserve to be top five.
When I did the men's first and then went on to the women and trying to pick, because I was doing them in order, I tried to pick number one. And I was trying to think of a reason that Ash Barty might not finish number one. And I mean, aside from the pandemic or maybe grounding her again or something like that, I couldn't think of one. I just think she's the best all-round player right now. But everybody else, I mean, I could have put 15 players in the top five, really, and made cases for. So, yeah. Paola Badosa is, to some degree, I really like her game, and I like the trajectory and the way she's embracing everything. And I don't feel like there's a lot of recent disappointment that is going to derail her. But who knows how she will move on in the sort of second season syndrome kind of thing of trying to back it up now. She's made this big breakthrough. Will she be okay with the next stage? Unknowns.
Okay. Well, look forward to having that played back to us in a year's time and feeling silly. Thanks very much, Mike. We have time, I think, for one more question. Mike has selected this from City Dweller Country Dreamer on Instagram. And he, she, or they say, I'd love to know how David does live commentary on the radio, how Catherine just comes up with stuff to say on live TV. Can you two discuss your non-podcast jobs in more depth? And for Matt, can we hear more about his stat gathering and what he hopes to do in addition to the podcast later in life?
Who's going first?
You, David. Oh, you right. Spoke up.
Okay. Well... how do I do live commentary on the radio? I don't really know. I remember when I first started, I did my first ever go at it in my wife's apartment watching an old recording of Goran Ivanišević against Pat Rafter in the 2001 Wimbledon final. And I just had a go and just tried to describe it. And I found it ever so difficult. But then when I did it for the first time for real in 2003 in the Australian Open... yeah, just because I was immersed in it, it started to all come to me. And the good news for me is it was a pretty small audience. So I could kind of try and figure out my way of doing things. Because the truth is, if you listen back to radio commentators from generations ago, they would literally try to describe every single shot that is taking place. Now, I find that I think I can do that. But I think it's difficult, and it's very difficult, I think, for the listener to be able to follow what's going on if you do it like that. So to me, and particularly on the station that I commentate on, I started to work out a bit of a shorthand of describing the feel of a rally, often sort of concentrating on just one of the players within the rally and describe what that player is doing, because by what that player is doing kind of tells you what the other player has already done. In terms of which side they've pushed them onto, whether they've pushed them back in the court or forward in the court, and what the one you're focusing on is trying to do to negate the opposition or to put pressure on. And so often if it's just a rallying trade going on from the back of the court, won't describe every single shot because a lot of them are kind of irrelevant. These rally ball shots, they're not doing much to decide the outcome of the point. Then you'll feel this injection. Somebody's hit it deeper or shorter or really gone after it and injected some pace and is attacking the net, and you can you adapt accordingly. So I suppose the pace of a rally and the feel and the volume that I'm speaking at will depend on just where they are in that rally at any given time. And then using, in the good times, the pre-pandemic and hopefully post-pandemic times, using the crowd, using the sound of the crowd to determine the volume that I'm speaking at and the excitement levels and the speed with which I am delivering a commentary. And often there's a big exclamation mark to a winning shot. Try to get that winning shot description in just before the crowd realizes it's the end of the point, and then they will be the exclamation point to let you know what it was actually like in the stadium. So apart from that, it's chat between the points, talking points, a bit like we're doing on the podcast right now. Colour, what's going on around. If somebody's bringing in a plate full of beer and hot dogs, then I'm going to be watching that and talking about it. And yeah, it's just, I don't know, developed over the years. But I'll listen back. I'll listen back to pretty much every commentary I ever do. I'll listen back to a bit of it because the things I want to know that I'm doing, and there are things I want to know that I'm not doing. And when I hear the ones that I don't want to be hearing, I have to correct it because there's some things that I do that really irritate me. And so I've learnt that if you listen back to it, you can self-correct.
That was an instructional for everybody listening. You've just trained up the next generation of, well, your successors, David.
I don't know whether that's...
That was brilliant.
That's right, but that's just how I do it.
Can I check? So you said your first commentary experience, like properly, was what, the 2003 Australian Open?
Yeah.
So how did you end up doing commentary? Were you there in another capacity and they got you on as a commentator as well? Or did they just say, you're a commentator? Like, how did that go?
Yeah, is it a bit like the pole vault, David? How do you do it for the first time? Just sink or swim?
I was thinking pole vault, weren't you, David? As in, on Twitter.
Yes.
The pole vault.
I was absolutely thinking that, Matt. I went out there and just sort of paid my own way to go out there on the understanding that I might have a chance. They were just launching this station on BBC Radio for more commentaries on a digital service. And they'd said, you know, we're just trying to build this thing. And if they knew I was interested in it and that I had all these contacts and whatever within tennis through my previous jobs, and if I was out there, then they would give me a chance to have a go. And so I did that. And I remember the first match that I ever did was Mark Philippoussis against Paradorn Srisipan in the night session in the Australian Open. And it was an incredible match, 5 sets. I mean, I would find it excruciating to listen to now. I would be so awful in my ears. I would think it was terrible. But the only way you can really learn how to do it is just to do it and find out if you've got any sort of ability at it, if it comes naturally to you or not. And then, like I say, I listen back to it a lot and ask advice as well.
Well, the exact same applies to TV presenting for me. I didn't know I could do it until I did it. I had no idea. There's no way of replicating the scenario of, you know, that red light going on and the pressure being on you and people talking in your ear. There's not really any way to replicate that in other areas of life. So, you know, there's two distinct things with my role. There's the real mechanics of TV presenting, delivering links, almost always without an auto cue. I mean, I prefer without an auto cue personally. But anyway, there's delivering links. There's knowing which camera to look at, knowing how to look at the camera, following the directions in your ear. Very various different skills that accompany all of those things. And then there's the, you know, what's referenced specifically in this question is how does Catherine just come up with stuff to say on live TV? Well, for me, that's the easy bit because of the podcast. You know, I find my job, my day job, it's easiest when I just feel like it's the podcast and we're just getting stuck into chat and I'm asking the guest questions because I'm interested to know the answer. That's when the job's easy. It's just sitting and chatting about something that I love with experts on the subject. What could be better? And goodness me, I feel sorry for people that have to sort of be thrown into that sink or swim situation without sort of years and years of podcasting experience behind them, because it's like I was in training for it. It's the absolute perfect preparation. And quite often, you know, during the slams when we're doing daily podcasts, I'm totally giving away trade secrets here, but I can just replicate chats that we've had, you know, 12 hours before on the podcast, and I can bring them to the TV. It's like having a superpower. doing this podcast in terms of my TV presenting. So yeah, there's sort of two distinct parts of the job, and the just chatting about tennis, that's the easiest bit, I think. Chatting about tennis whilst, you know, remembering to every now and then glance at the right camera and having one eye on the link that's coming up and having someone counting down in your ear and following a running order and all of that, that's when sort of different skills come into play. But just knowing what questions to ask, well, generally speaking, I ask what I'm interested to know, because first and foremost, I'm a tennis fan, and that's the angle I try to come at it with. Now, Matt, we can't put this off any longer. Have to come to you. The questions for you were, can we hear more about your stat gathering and what you hope to do in addition to the podcast in later life?
This feels very small time now compared to live TV presenting and commentating on the radio.
Well, no, they've asked about you can cover your whole future life in this answer,
yeah,
Matt.
True. I mean, I think in terms of stats, I sort of think of them as facts, really. I've always had a brain for wanting to just know sports facts, and I've been good at absorbing sports facts. And I think that's the key. I just get an idea, a spark for something I'm interested in, and then just go with it. And the truth is, I don't have any access to more data than anyone listening to this podcast now. You know, I've got maybe a few email addresses at the WTA or the ATP or the ITF, people who do have access to databases, and sometimes I use them to help me, but most of the time I do it on my own. You know, it's a lot of just looking through old draws and player records. You've just got to have the patience and the will to do that, really, yourself. In terms of beyond the podcast, God, what a horrible thought. Let's go in addition to the podcast.
The question was in addition to the podcast, Matt.
That's what it says. Okay. I'd like to explore writing more, you know, long form, I suppose. I sort of get to give my opinions on here. I get to give match reports on here. And that's the way I like to consume sort of that quick, instant tennis content, I suppose. I love it doing it on here in podcast form. But I like long-form writing, and I like reading long-form writing and getting into a topic and speaking to people about it, constructing it. I would love to do more of that. I get a lot of pleasure out of a finished, written piece of work. I always have. And, you know, maybe that would develop into writing a book one day. That would be the sort of ultimate aim, I think. But I'm aware that you can just say, I want to write a book. There's a lot more to it than that. But I'd like to have a go. I think I would regret later in life if I've not attempted to write a book.
I'd read
it. I want to read your book, Matt. Yes, so no pressure, but you're definitely doing that. Wow, gosh, how interesting. I have learned how to commentate on Grand Slam finals and aspire to be an author. I've just listened to a sort of tutorial. Brilliant. What a great selection of questions. Thank you to everybody that sent them in. And thank you in particular to Mike Lee, our guest editor for the week. Next week's episode is also a listener question special. And it's a good job it is, because honestly, we had so many great questions come in. You've done us proud, as you always do. So we'll be back with another one next week. Thank you to Mike for this week. Top-notch selection of questions. And as you can tell, we're with you on being fans of the underarm serve. We are, of course, as we will always be from now on, still open to new friends of the tennis podcast. It's your way of getting more from us as a podcast. You can access the Friends of the Tennis Podcast dedicated feed, which already features a brand new podcast called My First Wimbledon, featuring the story of how I destroyed my parents' home with accompanying photos. And there are six podcasts from our archive on there as well. Friends also get several new shows before the Australian Open begins, including two new editions of Tennis Relived, which we're planning at the moment. So if you want to become a friend to get access to the extra pods, to lend your help and support to everything that we do, including the well over 100 free podcasts that we'll be producing in 2022, then become a friend of the Tennis Podcast. The link is in the show notes and across all of our platforms as well. Our first podcast on the main Tennis Podcast feed in 2022 will be our season preview on January the 3rd. But of course, as I say, we'll be back before that with one more listener question special next week. Important last business. We have a mascot this week. It is Georgie, a Whippet Lurcher cross, who turns 3 on Christmas Eve. She's owned by Beth, and she was rescued from a shelter in Belfast, and she now lives in Edinburgh. And honestly, she's so gorgeous. There's a picture of her on the beach here, and she's the exact same colour as the sand, and she just looks just so happy. They're gorgeous dogs, well, Whippets and Lurchers, but yeah, she's absolutely gorgeous. They've got such characterful faces. There's one here of her in what looks like a Christmas hat, but with leopard print trim, which is just marvellous. Well done, Georgie, and well done, Beth, for owning Georgie. We have our own mascots, Scouser, Mousel, Rogue and Zeus. We have Billie Jean King and Alana that sponsor Billie Jean. And of course, we have Chris Albert-Lee, our executive producer and top bloke. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting us via Friends of the Tennis Podcast. We'll be back with one more of these listener question specials next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.